Herb was kind enough to talk about the book, How We Die, that changed my life in the early 90s from being a busy surgeon in a busy university community to suddenly being proclaimed an oracle on the subject of death, which I didn't realize I had spent my life thinking about and actually planning to write this book until after I had written it. And let me tell you what I mean. I was born in an immigrant family, and the legend of the family was about my grandfather and two uncles who came from a small village in what is now Belarus and who developed tuberculosis in the early 20th century, as so many immigrants did on the Lower East Side, and died before my grandmother and the girls in the family could come over. One of those girls died in childbirth. Another of those girls died in her 30s of Bright's disease. I had a brother who was stillborn. I had another brother who died at the age of 3. Death, without my really acknowledging it, was in the legend and lore of my family. And my mother died of colon cancer when I was 11 after a very prolonged course. And I realized, looking back on it, obviously, that this is what drove me to medicine. It wasn't the fear of death. It was having control over disease. If I were to become a doctor, I could stop the disease that had decimated my family over the course of three generations. And so there I was. I went into a surgical residency, developed the usual busy surgical practice. I'd been at it for about 35 years. And one day, my secretary, not one of the nurses, my secretary walked into the examining room where I was just finishing up a physical examination of a new patient. And she whispered in my ear, secretary, they never walk into examining rooms. You're not supposed to do that. She whispered in my ear, there's a phone call. I think you'll want to take this. And I said, who's it from? She said, the magic words. She said, it's a literary agent. Well, I had written a book on the history of medicine, and so I had a little bit of taste of the writing life and how much fun it can be. And I finished the examination. I was actually near the very end. I mean, it was literally near the end. I was at the end. I was doing the rectal exam. So I slipped out, and I slipped out of the room, and I went to speak to this fellow on the phone who introduced himself to me, and he said that he had an idea for a book, an original idea. And he had been speaking to some editors in New York, and they knew about some of the previous writing I'd done, and then my name kept coming up, and he said, I thought I'd try you. What is the book to be about? He said, do you know that there is no book, either for the medical profession or for the laity, that actually talks about the details of how people die of coronary disease, cancer, old age, dementia, whatever? And I said, there must be lots of such books. That was our first conversation. He said, well, try me just over the next couple of days, visit some libraries. And I did. I went to the Yale Medical Library, nothing for students, nothing for house officers or faculty. And, of course, in the New Haven Public Libraries, it was the same thing. So lo and behold, there was really nothing available. And here we were, near the beginning of the hospice movement, near the beginning of the growth of bioethics, the beginning, only the beginning of the awareness of how badly we treat people at the end of life. And yet, if you wanted to know what actually happens to someone with long-standing malignancy, there was no way to find out what that person feels, what his or her doctors feel, what they go through physically, but also emotionally, primarily physically, though there wasn't any such thing. So I took him up on it, and I wrote this book. took me exactly a year. It took me I took a year's leave of absence, and it took me 365 days. I never spoke to him for the whole. He had no idea what I was going to do with this book, and neither did I. But I found, to my astonishment, that the book wrote itself. It came off the end of my Eberhard Faber 2.5 pencil. I write on double-line stationery. I shouldn't say double-line. I write on every other line. Double-line stationery is what they give you in Hebrew school, which is how I first learned to do that. But I have one of these things. You see, it's close to a nubbin now because I was working on the plane. And I wrote it out that way, and when it was published, it was barely edited. Something in my unconscious mind had told me what I should write. And when I came to the chapter on old age, and this is a story I've told a number of times, and I don't want ever to forget it, I realized and remembered that for the first 17 years of my life, I had been living with a woman who was dying of old age. She died at 97, my grandmother, who we called Bubba in the Eastern European way. And I watched that slow deterioration, and I remember distinctly, my wife was at home at that time. I walked into the kitchen, and I said, you know, I'm writing about old age, and I want to write about my Bubba, but who will care about a 4 foot, 10 inch woman who couldn't speak a word of English, who had no idea what this culture was all about? Who can identify with such a person? And she said three words to me. She said, don't censor yourself. Just write what you think needs to be written. Well, I didn't think. It was all, again, out of the unconscious, and I wrote that chapter. And an astonishing thing happened after the book came out. You know, you get a lot of letters about a book. And one of the letters came from a man named Jim Barnes, who described himself as a pig farmer in Iowa. And he wrote this in longhand. He wrote this four-page letter, and at the end of it, he said, and lastly, but most important, thank you for your Bubba. I knew her at a different time, by a different name, in a different place. And suddenly I understood something. What I understood was that the more personal one becomes in one's writing, the more universal one is. My own deepest unacknowledged thoughts that just poured out on the paper turned out to be so universal without my realizing it, that this book has been translated into 29 languages now. And as many of you know, that this book was an extraordinary sensation, because it really was true that here we were at the beginnings of our discussions of death and dying and the way we care for people and their spiritual needs and their physical needs, and nobody knew how it happened. Doctors had to learn it by being at bedsides over and over and over again, because nobody taught it in the classroom. And when the book had been out 15 years, my publisher, Alfred A. Knopf Company, contacted me and said, you know, it's been 15 years. Why don't you write a follow-up? Why don't you write not a new book, but a coda, a new ending, a new summary? What's going on now? Have things changed? So I spent close to a year visiting places that I had visited before, talking to people I had met along the way, physicians, nurses, hospice workers, members of the clergy, aides who I had run into. And primarily, though, I was talking to people very much like myself, younger than myself, because almost everybody's younger than myself now, and finding out what had happened primarily to medicine. With all of the press from the general public, all of the demand for compassionate care of the dying, all of the need for knowledge, what had happened in 15 years in America? And I wrote this coda, this final chapter, this new summary, and I want to tell you what my findings were. And the findings turn out to be very, very different from what I had gradually come to believe. There were some things that were quite encouraging and some things that were very shocking. After all the time passed, all the enlightenment, all of the new knowledge, all of the seeming progress in medicine itself, we seem to remain in this one area, the area of how we die, in a morass. Yes, there have been dramatic changes. Yes, there have been new ways of looking at the process of death and dying. Yes, there have been more ways of teaching medical students and residents about it. But in fact, have we made progress? And this is what I'd like to talk to you about this evening. What are the improvements that have taken place? Well, one of them I've just alluded to, an increasing awareness, an increasing sensitivity to our deficiencies, an increasing attention in the minds of everyone that matters have to change. Well, what have we done in teaching compassionate care to our medical students, who, after all, are the first line of defense? There have been a number of efforts, some of which are very well known about and some of which are less well known about, deliberate attempts to teach students compassionate care of the dying. We have classes in compassionate care of the dying. Call that, as a matter of fact, in the first 2 years, in just about every medical school in this country now, there is, whether it's a short seminar or a semester's worth, there will be a period of an hour a week set aside for this kind of teaching. There are classes in what we call professional responsibility, an attempt to bring to the students a feeling of the nobility of medicine, the traditions of medicine, the obligations of medicine to the community, the sense that medicine is indeed not even a profession, it is a calling. And those of us who are fortunate enough to be called to it have to think of it as though we were called to the ministry, and this is a lifelong absorption, a total absorption, and we must be proud of that calling. We've come to realize, and our historians have taught us this really, medicine is not a science. Medicine is an art that uses science as best as it can to heal, not necessarily to cure, but to heal. And healing, being a total body process, the physician herself or himself is part of the healing process. Hippocrates knew this. One of the great sayings in one of his, it's not his actually, there are a lot of people who wrote the Hippocratic books, but one of the great sayings is, sometimes, this is almost a direct quote, sometimes a patient will recover simply because he is convinced of the goodness of the physician. Actually, I'm engaged in a project right now to study this concept of what the physician's actual morality and goodness have to do with how she or he can be an effective healer. So the cultural aspects out of which medicine springs must be taught. Nowadays, if you look at a pre-medical student's curriculum for sophomore year or junior year, there's almost no time whatsoever on that curriculum for a course in English literature or in history or in philosophy or of any of the background knowledge that used to be perfectly straightforward for liberal arts students in a college 50 years ago. Because the pre-med requirements have become enormous, largely because of the splitting of biology, of chemistry into various fields, and the kids feeling, oh, I won't get into medical school if I don't do physical chemistry and this kind of specialized organic chemistry and that quantitative analysis, and some are rigid requirements, and some the kids take because they feel otherwise they'll be at a disadvantage. They spend their summers working in Professor X's lab or going off to Nigeria to help take care of the sick there with the missions, the medical missions that go, and they never sit under a tree and read Proust, like some of the doctors in this room certainly did. It is impossible for any person, any individual, to experience everything our culture has been through, and this is why we read fiction, because we learn what life is about from reading friction. That's interesting. Dr. Freud. Actually, Freud himself said this, that his theories had a lot to do with his wide reading of fiction. This is how you learn about human nature. But kids aren't learning about human nature now. They're learning about micromolecules. So there's this intent to teach courses in medical humanities. Northwestern University in Chicago, the Marquette campus of University of Wisconsin has a program, a department of medical humanities. And these would seem to have been very helpful in rounding out medical students who had very little contact with humanities. We give prizes to the most compassionate physician. Foundations give prizes to faculty members who are exemplary in caring for the sick, caring for the dying. Foundations do the same thing. The foundation I belong to, the Hastings Center, which is a bioethics think tank, gives awards to a senior physician, a junior physician, and a house officer. Large amounts of money, $25,000. I myself have the feeling that these awards may be exercises in futility. You're not going to be compassionate because someone tells you might win a prize 10 years down the pike. I'm one of these people who is convinced that you learn your morality at your mother's knee. And when medical students tell me, I have 2 weeks free in the middle, what do you suggest I should do? Because I teach undergraduates right now. I don't actually even teach medical students anymore. I say, go home. Hang around your mother. Hang around your minister. Hang around the people that you learn from to be the person you are. Don't go to the Bahamas and chase boys or girls or whatever you're chasing. And certainly stay away from the professor's laboratory. Don't volunteer to help him at all. And we teach classes in ethics. That's another thing that we try to teach. They are sometimes taught by card-carrying ethicists, and sometimes they're taught by doctors who have a particular interest in ethics. We have many kids who volunteer in hospices. You know, we have within 10 miles of New Haven America's first hospice, the Connecticut Hospice, and a good number of our medical students volunteer there, follow after the nurses, help out in the care of patients. So those are the changes. Those are the kinds of progress that have occurred in these 15 years in medical schools and among the doctors who teach medicine to students. Another great change has been the enormous mushrooming of the field of palliative care in general. Obviously, this was going on in 1994 when the book came out, but it is much, much larger today. A great deal more attention is being paid to palliative care, and doctors have developed a specialty of palliative care. The American Academy of Hospice in palliative care had already been founded in 1988, 6 years before I wrote my book. And in 1994, the year the book was published, they established an actual specialty board. And the American, I think it's American Academy of Board Specialists or something, supervises the exam now, so people are qualified and have a certificate, just like your internist or your surgeon or your psychiatrist is board qualified in palliative care. So that in itself is important progress. And then, of course, there's a growth of hospice. I don't have to tell members of this audience about the great work of Dr. Cicely Saunders, who started out as a social worker, or an almoner, as they call them in England, then became a nurse and then went to medical school, became a physician, and founded the two first hospices in London in 1967. In 1974, one of our own physicians at the Yale Medical School, actually the chairman of the urology department, spent a year working with her, came back, and with members of the clergy, members of the Yale Medical Faculty, formed Connecticut Hospice. And then hospices, of course, began to grow throughout the country. There are now 3,500 hospices, not necessarily institutional hospices. They may be outpatient facilities, but whatever it is, they are available and they are covered by Medicare, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Fully one-third of dying Americans use a hospice in one form or another before their deaths. And that's a huge increase from what it was when this book was written. 1 million people a year have been patients, either as outpatients at the hospice facility or actually as inpatients there. So there have been these remarkable, I think, changes. Another one is the growth of the profession of medical ethics or biomedical ethics. It didn't exist in 1967. People who study the history of the field and the history of philosophy, as a matter of fact, point out that American philosophy in general was in a bit of a quagmire at that time. They were seeking something new, and they fortunately found it in the notion of bioethics. And bioethics, which permeates now every aspect of medical care, has grown and grown and grown from the original think tanks to many think tanks. As many of you know, there have been two bioethics consultation groups, presidential consultation groups, formed, one during the Bush administration, interestingly enough. And then when the Obama administration came in, they felt that the commission they had was too theoretical, but they needed really practical advice, so they fired everybody and started with another group of much more practical-minded bioethicists. But they are there to give advice to the president. As you know, they were instrumental in many ways in being involved with the Affordable Care Act. Much of their advice was not followed, but at least they did have a hand in that. There are four principles to bioethics. Probably almost everybody here knows that. The first principle, autonomy. It is the life of the patient. It is not the life or value system of the doctor or of the clergyman or of the nurse or even necessarily the family. The patient must be an autonomous agent who is given all the information needed, all the information required, to then make a decision. Now, there are a lot of practical problems with this, but the thesis is basically the correct one and a very different way of looking at it than we did before the professional bioethicist came into being. Almost half a century ago now. The next principle is called beneficence, and this is one of the precepts in what I call the goodness of the physician. The third is almost the obverse of that, non-maleficence, the Hippocratic principle, first do no harm, primum non nocere. One does not, under any circumstances, do physical, psychological harm to a patient. This becomes a very, very complicated ball of wax when we think of all of the new treatments for malignancies of various sorts, which, of course, continue to make many people much worse than they were before they started therapy, some people to the point where they refuse therapy because they have seen what loved ones have gone through. And the fourth one, which has never been followed in our country, is justice. You all know we live in one of the few countries of the world where it is very difficult to get first-rate medical care unless you have the proper insurance, the proper amounts of money in your pocketbook, and the vast majority of Americans, other than the Medicare group, do not have that. And large parts of the Medicare group don't have it either because it's a matter of access, and access becomes very difficult. But these are the principles the bioethicists have tried to instill in the rest of us. Justice, autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence. Then another piece of progress, which was occurring already when this book came out in 1994, was the principle of advanced directives, which I'm sure everybody here is familiar with. The Patient Self-Determination Act had been passed by Congress in 1990. The Patient Self-Determination Act allows, if a patient cannot make a decision for himself or herself, for someone to be appointed a healthcare proxy or to have what's called by the lawyer's durable power of attorney to make decisions for that patient. Then an additional factor, an additional improvement, has been the fact that virtually every hospital in this country now has an ethics committee. Ethics committees are charged with solving problems that have to do with ethical responsibilities of physicians, of nurses, of the administration of a hospital, and the responsibilities of the hospital administration and the physicians to the patients. They consist, by and large, of what we call wise heads, senior members of a hospital faculty, of a hospital staff. There'll always be a lawyer or two. If they're lucky, they've got some very good people from the clergy, and there's a representative of the community. So every hospital has such a thing, and if any family or any patient feels that their personal humane rights are being challenged or violated, they can turn to the bioethics committee of any hospital for a judgment. And then finally, there's a factor that is vague, but very, very important, and it grows out of some of the other things I've been saying for the past few minutes. The whole idea of a return to the days of Hippocratic idealism. You know, Western medicine was really started about 350 years before the Common Era by a group of physicians who somehow became known by the name of one of their leaders, Hippocrates. And the Hippocratic doctors introduced a number of new things. They introduced the concept of physical examination. They introduced the idea that one doesn't become sick because the gods are angry with you and you're not going to get better because the gods say, yes, now you should be better. They said you get sick because there's some natural thing going on in your body, or there's something out in the climate that is doing it to you, or there may be a bunch of insects who come flooding in and bite you. These were all new ideas. But they also, in addition to everything else, brought in this concept of the physician's morality and goodness, and how the physician himself, and of course in those days it was always himself, by his very presence can instill in a patient the will to get better. We now know with modern studies of placebos that the placebo effect is probably about a third of the effect of the real medicines we take, like the digitalis and the antibiotics and all of this, about a third of it. And when it comes to the drugs that influence mood disorders like depression, it may be a lot more than that. The New York Review of Books recently ran two articles by Marcia Angel, who used to be the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, arguing that antidepressants, for example, are pharmacologically much less effective than we have thought, and the actual reasons people get better have to do with that placebo effect and the passage of time. So, you know, this becomes another interesting thing to conjure with. But the real question, and the question that I started to attack when they contacted me and said, you know, we need another chapter bringing things up to date, the real question is, has how we die in America really changed? In spite of all of the progress, are we moving forward or are we standing still? And I concluded, after all the contacts I made, the places I visited, the people I spoke to, all the bull sessions I had with colleagues, that the French were right. You remember their old saying, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more things stay the same. And I must tell you that for every one of the ameliorations and improvements I've just described, there are reasons to worry. There are reasons to worry about the present, but perhaps even more so, reasons that we have to worry about the future. A lot of them have to do with the technology of medicine, how it has grown enormously, logarithmically, any way you can imagine in these past 15 years, but some of them have to do with other things as well. When you look at a medical school curriculum, I spoke earlier about all the changes we've had in the curriculum, you realize that classroom exercises occur essentially only in the first 2 years. Then the kids get on the wards, but the first 2 years there's time for classes, there's time for didactic work. All other teaching after that is from observation, from participation, from going on rounds, little seminars where people sit around, discuss a topic, or grand rounds where a major topic is discussed, but actual classroom exercises occur only in the first 2 years. A remarkable thing happens at the beginning of the third year, and this hasn't changed in 60 years. Students go on the wards. It's a very exciting time. It is breathlessly exciting. And it turns out, after looking at this whole picture, that the classroom doesn't translate very well to the intensive care unit. What people learn about humanities and ethics and responsibility to the values of the patient, what they learn about the humanities disappears in the thrill of the chase. In this book, How We Die, I talked about what I call the riddle, the exciting riddle of diagnosis and therapy. Suddenly they give you a white coat and a stethoscope and you're a doctor, and my God, it's unbelievable. What a feeling that is. If you've ever flown a Spitfire in combat, which I never did, I imagine it must be exactly like that. In fact, I always call the interns Spitfire pilots. And there are those Messerschmitts, you know, up there, the bacteria and the who knows what, and they're shooting them down, and it's great fun. And most of their teachers are very young, too, because who teaches medical students? The residents teach the medical students. The junior attendings teach the residents. You don't get a lot of gray hair on the wards. You get young, excited, enthusiastic people taking care of the sick when often what is needed, as you well know, needed much more, is wisdom, is compassion, Buddhist principles, yes, but principles for all of us. The classroom doesn't translate well to the realities of the bedside, and perfectly honestly, it has not been my impression as I see these young people on the wards or the people teaching them, that what we have attempted to gradually soak into their psyches has stayed there. It has dried up in the excitement of the new liquid in which they've submerged themselves, the liquid of salvaging a life, because that's what it's all about. It's all about cure, and it isn't about care, and those are two very, very different things. So we have the fact that the classes have to be in the first and second year because the kids don't have time to come off the wards and sit down and talk about Tolstoy. They just can't do it, or talk about ethics. What about the great influence of the hospice movement and the palliative care movement? In 2010, when I finished my survey, and just before that last chapter was published in the new edition of How We Die, there were 1,300 men and women who had passed their specialty boards in palliative care. 1,300 people. Do you know how many dermatologists there are? 8,500. It's a shocking figure. There are 700,000 doctors in America, and of those, only 1,300 are boarded in palliative care. Statistically, there is one for every three hospices in this country. So many of the outpatient facilities for hospice are not in any way supervised or involved with physicians, except the patient's individual physicians, who may have different ways of looking at things, which actually I'll talk about in a moment. I talked about the fact that there is a Medicare provision for patients who go into hospice. Medicare will pay for hospice care. But if you look at the law, it gets a little scary because there are certain provisions that come along with it. The physician must certify that the patient has less than 6 months to live. I don't know too many physicians who are willing to prognosticate that way, who are willing 6 months before death to say this person has less than 6 months to live. There's also this very difficult psychological problem of a patient going into a hospice 6 months or 5 months or 7 months before this almost arbitrary date. How do you start that conversation? How do you 6 months before death have someone face the reality that the rest of treatment is futile? You just can't do that. Another provision for hospice care is that each patient admitted to a hospice unit must have a primary caregiver. You have no idea how many people over the age of 65 live isolated lives. Sociologists have written about this problem. Nobody to take care of them. There is no full-time caregiver for many, many, many Americans who would be eligible for hospice. And the other snare in all of this is that if the patient goes into a hospice unit, he or she must from then on refuse any therapeutic care. So the patient must agree from now on in, no attempts at therapy will be tried. Well, there's therapy in this therapy. There's therapy in the attempt to cure disease, but there's therapy also in an attempt to relieve symptoms. The classic example is people with a deposit in a bone where a dose of X-ray will solve the pain problem, for example. You can't do that. There have been, one very recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine, there have been several other articles indicating that for lung cancer patients, if you give therapeutic care and hospice care at the same time, the patients live a little longer, but that's not the issue. They live better. They live more comfortably, and they live in a state of much better equanimity than they had before. But if you have Medicare covering your hospice, you can't do that. So there are all of these problems. I talked about the physicians themselves. I wrote about a problem in how we die that hasn't changed one bit, as far as I can tell. The tremendous reluctance of many, many physicians to recommend that patients take on hospice care. I think 1/3 of Americans is not a lot. It sounds good when you compare it to 15 years ago, but it really isn't a lot, and it isn't enough. Doctors have different motivations for this. We tend, as many of you know, to be a little power hungry. We don't like to give up control of a patient. Some of us, I'm afraid, actually think in financial terms about control of a patient, but for most of us, it's something else. You don't want to turn a patient over to somebody else because you feel a sense of responsibility, but more importantly, you have this authority, and that's one of the reasons that there are physicians in every community in America who refuse to refer patients to hospice. You know, one of the nifty things about writing a book is you get to go on TV shows and meet all these people you've been surreptitiously watching in the afternoon, like Oprah Winfrey. So I was on the Oprah Winfrey show. It was a wonderful moment in my life, you know. I think I peaked at that moment, at least in the opinion of my children. And when we finished, it was a very emotional hour. And when we finished, you know, they do it live. They tape it, and then they show it again. But it's done live before a live audience. As soon as we finished, two women, perhaps in their 40s, came rushing up onto this little stage. Turned out they were both hospice nurses from Chicago. And their question to me is, what can we do to convince doctors to refer patients to hospice? And that hasn't changed very much at all. It really hasn't. So there we are. Now, I talked about advanced directives. Patients can decide, if I have to be intubated, do I want to be intubated? If I'm on life-sustaining drugs without which I would die, do I want to keep that up? Well, that's fine, and you can go to your lawyer's office and write out your advance directives. You can do it when you come into the hospital. This has been known since the law was passed in 1992. 1/4 of Americans have taken advantage of it. That's all. Just 1/4 of Americans. So advance directives haven't helped an awful lot. Plus, how many times have I seen or heard of doctors who refuse to obey a patient's advance directives, who say, but this is a mistake. This person didn't understand what we can do now, and they continue the treatment. Or the other thing, the great Nancy from Dubuque story. You know, we write about families, the family this, the family that. The family's not a monolith. The family consists of a bunch of people, and they all have ideas. So mom's in the hospital, and she's got advance directives that she doesn't want to be on a respirator. And Joe, with whom she lives, her son Joe, says, okay, that's fine. Her daughter Mary, who lives in the next town, says, that's what we're going to do. That mom and I talked about this. And just as they're about to stop the respirator, in flies Nancy from Dubuque. And she hasn't talked to her mother since 3 Christmases ago, and she's feeling dreadfully guilty. And no, we have to do everything. So there go advance directives. So there are problems with every one of these bits of progress. What about ethics committees? They ought to be able to decide everything. When advance directives come up and a doctor says, I won't follow them, you go to the ethics committee and they say, there it is, you've got to follow it. And since the doctors on such committees tend to have a lot of gray hair, people say, oh, yes, wisdom is here, we'll do what they say. Well, I love talking to families who come to me, and because a lot do, and say this happened or that happened. I said, well, did you ever go to the ethics committee? Or you can go to the ethics committee. Do you know what most of the time the response is? What's an ethics committee? Most people don't know hospitals have ethics committees. It's an amazing phenomenon. So that hasn't been much help either. So who consults them? Very often it's doctors who've made up their minds about something and just simply want a group of senior people to say, yes, this is the right thing to do. So they provide consent. Who are on these ethics committees? Do they have any training? Do they understand ethical dilemmas that have been written about in the bioethics literature? Do they know the precedents to the cases they're talking about? Who knows? Some hospitals, yes. Some hospitals, no. And then there's this other thing that has come up, which is hospital, government, and insurance regulations. This kind of thing didn't go on 15 years ago. Do you know that administrators make rounds on every patient in the hospital? They check every chart, and they do it to make sure that every insurance requirement has been filled out so the hospital gets its money. These are administrators who, as a colleague said to me one day when we were talking about this problem, they don't know who we are. They don't know who the doctors are. They don't know how doctors think about disease. They don't know how nurses think about disease. They don't know how ministers, pastoral care workers think about disease. They're just there trying to make sure patients are gotten out of the hospital as soon as possible. Then there's this other bugaboo called best practices, which you've read about in the newspapers. Well, I don't want to take all night talking about best practices, but they are derived in very questionable ways. Remember, each individual is a distinct human being with a distinct set of problems. The average Medicare patient, before he dies or she dies, will have five major diagnoses. They have prostate cancer, they may have chronic lung disease, they may have congestive heart failure, they may have dementia, and best practices are derived by studying patients who have one disease so that nothing contaminates them. So they tend to be unrealistic. So many doctors have gotten involved in the business aspects of medicine that in self-defense they rush off and get MBAs. The chairman of my department at Yale has an MBA. He writes his name is MD, MBA, and then FACS. His membership in the American College of Surgeons is behind his MBA. You go into a big group practice, and one of the doctors in the group has gotten an MBA. Doctors are busier than ever filling out insurance requirements. The average length of visit, as many have read, is between 7 and 12 minutes in a doctor's office. Very often the doctor doesn't look up from her computer because she's so busy entering the material. How can people understand sick patients? And then there are other rules and regulations, but first let me quote a very senior faculty member at a major university center in a city other than my own. Quote, much of the reconfiguration of healthcare has been hijacked by economic needs. He's a doctor so famous for writing, as a matter of fact, that everybody here would know his name if I told you what it is. Some years ago, a young woman named Libby Zion was admitted to the New York hospital by an intern at night, and she was in a delirium, and a lot of other things were wrong with her, and they gave her some sedatives because she was being quite wild, and she never bothered to say she had taken cocaine very recently. In fact, she denied taking cocaine, and she died. And the hospital was accused of not properly supervising its residents. The residents worked too many hours. So in America now, residents, the people who really care for you at the bedside, can only work 80 hours a week. That's a lot. You may think it's a lot. In the days when doctors were giants, we used to work 120 hours a week. And you know why? Because a disease does not stay as it presents itself in the emergency room. It changes hour by hour by hour by hour. And during your training years, you must just watch that disease develop. You've got to watch it evolve to know exactly how to treat it, and you've got to watch it evolve so you understand the patient who has it, and you've got to watch it evolve so you can give proper treatment. Young doctors have become what one of my colleagues calls shift workers. So there's very little continuity of care. To add to that, there are 30,000 doctors in this country who are called hospitalists. So when you're admitted to a hospital, your doctor who has known you and your value system and what you want at the end of life can't take care of you. You are assigned to a hospitalist who doesn't know you. One of my friends, who is a senior Yale faculty member, fell down, got a concussion, slashed the side of his face open, broke a facial bone, and when I visited him on the third day, he had been seen by somewhere between 5 and 7 doctors, not his own, and he didn't know the name of a single one of them. So what about patients who are dying? What about patients for whom the most valuable thing a doctor can give is understanding and compassion? By knowing their values, by knowing their religious beliefs, by knowing the way they relate to their families, help them make decisions at the end of life. It doesn't anymore exist. Young doctors are taught to treat by algorithms now. Patient has this symptom, he gets this diagnostic test. If it's positive, he gets this diagnostic test. If that's positive, he gets this therapy. The notion of judgment, the notion of individualization, the notion of putting hands on a belly. Watch television. Every doctor you see examining a patient with a stethoscope examines through the shirt. Just watch. They never lift up the shirt to put the stethoscope on the skin. But when that stethoscope was invented, it was about a foot long. You could divide it in two and put it in your headband. There was a lot of controversy about it. One of the controversies was some people understood the metaphor. They understood the symbolism, and they were actually writing, this is the first thing we've ever had in medicine that physically separates us from patients. And you watch this, it's going to change. We will be separated from patients. And lo and behold, that is what has happened with modern technology. That's essentially it. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse. A new generation of doctors is being raised under such constraints, suffocated by demands being made of them, the demands for objectivity, the demands for measurement, the demands for calculation. We live today in the age of the image, as you well know, the age of the laboratory, the age of cost constraints, empathy, autonomy, caring, simple, unhurried kindness is not measurable, and it is lost, and it is lost because these things are encumbrances to quantifiable efficiency. And so where is hope? Where is hope for the dying who have no hope of avoiding their own deaths? What sort of psychological, spiritual, moral hope can they look to? Well, in the book How We Die, I have a list of ways in which hope can be shared with people who are dying. But since that book came out, I read Disturbing the Peace by Vaclav Havel. These were interviews made shortly after he came out of prison. And he wrote a wonderful thing about hope that applies specifically to the case at the end of life. And I want to read it to you as he wrote it in his book. Hope is not prognostication. It's not prediction. It's an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced, and it's anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not because it stands a chance to succeed. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. In short, I think that the deepest, most important form of hope, the only one that can keep us above water and urge us to good works, and the only true source of the breathtaking dimension of the human spirit and its efforts is something we get, as it were, from elsewhere. There is hope for the dying, I believe, in Havel's words. This is an extra dimension of the human spirit, and it has to do with our sense of the immortality and the sense of the memory of what we are and of what we stood for and of our values to those we leave behind us. Our aim is to avoid the inevitability of the kind of death that's forced on us still in modern hospitals, even though there are economic, biotechnological forces that would have it otherwise. We must resist. Sometimes we must resist forcefully. And I have a few suggestions. The word for funeral in the Hebrew is levaya, which means, it's a verb, actually, to accompany. And the reason one accompanies at a funeral, the way it works out, is a hearse will pull up. Six friends of the departed will carry the coffin to the gravesite, a distance perhaps sometimes as long as a fifth of a mile. That is the accompaniment. My argument is that when it becomes clear that there's death on the horizon, that is when we, as physicians, as nurses, as clergy, as aid workers, should begin to accompany the dying to their last moments. That is when we should begin the discussions about what the end of life for that individual, that unique individual, must be. It cannot wait for the last 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 days. You know, most hospice patients are admitted within 3 to 4 weeks of dying. Some of them are admitted the night before. There is no levaya. There is no accompaniment. There is no chance for people who are taking care of that during those last few moments to get to know them at all, to know their value systems or their family value system. So that's one thing that we must think about doing. We must restore the pastoral aspects of medicine. Those Hippocratic values that tell us that all of our patients are our moral and not just professional responsibility. Again, as I said earlier, that this is a calling and that death itself obviously is not a disease and it should not be medicalized. There is a point when the function of the physician is as counselor, as pastor, in addition to the other obvious pastoral help that is coming along. We have to restore the pastoral aspects. We have to restore that Hippocratic philosophy. There's a wonderful quote in one of his books. It's called Ethics. Where love of mankind is, there is also love of the art. They called medicine the art, and they knew then that it was an art, and we should remember now it is an art. We need far more family physicians than we have, and it is absolutely necessary to quantify medical income so that family physicians are not earning one-fifth to one-sixth what dermatologists are earning. You see, I have this thing about dermatologists. Pretty clear. We need an up-and-down study of the American medical system, the American medical educational system, and it has to be done by a large group of people, and we must teach our medical students that they have to emphasize care at least as much as they emphasize cure. And it is incumbent on those who do the study, of American medicine, to recognize what the old Hippocratic physicians used as some of their values, including the value of predicting as long beforehand as one possibly can. To recognize when death is imminent or at least on the horizon, and at that point to recognize also that death is not a disease and dying is not a medical condition. And once that is realized and accepted, to continue and to increase the way they nurture the patient and nurture the family, and in this way to nurture ourselves, because the real secret of healing lies in the nurture. Thank you very much.